Let's say, for instance, that I decided I didn't quite like Gravity. Personally, I found it quite bigoted and I wanted to cancel Gravity. Perhaps I organized protests against Gravity. Would that mean if I jumped off a cliff, I'd start floating instead? Well, of course not, right? It doesn't matter what I think about this law, the law still exists. In fact, much more likely, even though I disagreed with it, you'd probably still find me living in a way which my actions showed that deep down I still believed in gravity. In other words, I wouldn't be jumping off rooftops and cliffs. We live in a world where there is more access to information than ever before. Generations, young and old, are being exposed to radically different ideologies and opinions every day. It can be so overwhelming trying to decipher what's true and what's false. But there is a way. Join me as we discuss some of the toughest questions out there about Christianity, the Bible, and culture. I'm your host, Nick Lackey. Welcome to The Garrison. Hey everyone, and welcome back to The Garrison. After a short temporary break, we are back recording in the studio, which is a great feeling. Thank you everybody for your patience. The reason that we had that wee break was because I was quite busy over summer speaking at different camps, and also I'm building a new studio, which I've mentioned before. Now, if you're watching on YouTube, I'm sorry to disappoint you, but that's not quite up ready to go yet. Hopefully, in the next month or so, it will be ready and you'll start seeing that new studio. But for now, we're still in the old one. But fortunately, it's a nice cold day, so it's not a sauna in this room quite yet anyway. Now, these next four podcast episodes that you're going to be hearing as I release them, they are actually re-recordings of talks that I have been doing at various different camps. Originally, the plan was to just use the audio from the talk itself, but unfortunately, the audio wasn't quite up to the standard I wanted it to be anyway. So I've come into the studio to record them onto the podcast mic for your guys' entertainment and I suppose educational purposes as well, or for whatever reason you listen to this podcast. And I want everything, that all the content that I produce, to be as free and accessible as possible. So with that being said, I've got two more things to say before we get into the topic for today, which is the axiological argument. The first thing is that if you guys have any questions, please feel free to email me on thegarrisonpod@gmail.com. I'd love to answer them, if not just by emailing back, as an actual podcast episode as well. I'm always looking for content ideas, so if you have questions about Christianity, culture, the Bible, etc., then I'd love to answer them in a podcast episode. And the other thing is, just before I read out the first kind of 2-3 minutes of this podcast episode on the axiological argument, if you're going for a drive or if you're on a nice walk around the river, I'm sorry to say, but this next 2 or 3 minutes may ruin your experience. You'll find out why if you listen. I'm about to read out a pretty horrible story. So if you've got young kids around you, disclaimer, this is pretty nasty what I'm about to read. So you may not want to listen to this first 2 or 3 minutes. With that being said, I'm going to read a description of what happened during the Cambodian genocide in a prison called S21. According to Wikipedia, most prisoners at S21 were held there for 2 to 3 months. However, several high-ranking Khmer Rouge cadres were held longer. Within 2 or 3 days after they were brought to S21, all prisoners were taken for interrogation. The torture system at S21 was designed to make prisoners confess to whatever crimes that they were charged with by their captors. Prisoners were routinely beaten and tortured with electric shocks, searing hot metal instruments, and hanging, as well as the use of various other devices. Some prisoners were cut with knives or suffocated with plastic bags. Other methods for generating confessions included pulling out fingernails while pouring alcohol on the wounds, holding prisoners' heads underwater, and the use of the waterboarding technique. Women were sometimes raped by the interrogators. Although many prisoners died from this kind of abuse, killing them outright was discouraged, since the Khmer Rouge needed their confessions. The medical unit at S21, however, did kill at least 100 prisoners by bleeding them to death. It is proven that medical experiments were performed on certain prisoners. There is clear evidence that patients in Cambodia were sliced open and had organs removed with no anesthetic. The camp's director, Kan Kik Lu, has acknowledged that live prisoners were used for surgical study and training. Draining blood was also done. If you search up victims of S21, you'll find pictures of young kids, kids probably younger than 10 years old, who were put in this prison. I'm sorry if I've made you feel sick, disgusted, angry, or uncomfortable. And to be honest, I felt that too when I read that out, for the first time and this time as well. What I've just described has ignited in you one of your strongest systems in your body. And this system is so strong that it guides our decisions, and it has the ability to change how we feel physically and emotionally. The system which I'm talking about is our conscience. Now, the word conscience is made up of two words, con and science. Con means with, and science means knowledge. So in other words, when we commit evil or when we see other acts of evil, we do it with knowledge of whether it's right or wrong. And the conscience that we have is not a physical part of us like an organ, but it is rather something else that God has placed within us. And here's what I mean. In the Bible, in Romans chapter 2, verses 14 to 15, it says, "For when Gentiles who do not have the law by nature do the things in the law, these, although not having the law, are a law to themselves, who show the work of the law written in their heart, their conscience also bearing witness, and between themselves their thoughts accusing or else excusing them. In the day when God will judge the secrets of men by Jesus Christ, according to my gospel." God has written morality on our heart. That's why when I read up the horrors of that S21 prison, you knew naturally that it was wrong. We never needed to be taught that by our parents or school teachers. And the conscience is the key to the next argument. Other arguments for God are intellectually strong, but this argument will strike people in their hearts. Their intellect won't wiggle them out of this, and their conscience will tell them that it is true. And that's why I personally think that this argument is one of the strongest arguments ever for the existence of God. So, the axiological argument, how does it go? Well, this is a simple deductive argument, and it's got two premises and a conclusion. And basically, if the two premises are true, then that means the conclusion must also be true. So the first premise is that every law has a lawgiver. The second premise, the universe has a moral law. And the third part of the argument, the conclusion, therefore, the universe has a moral lawgiver. Now, the Merriam-Webster dictionary defines axiology as the study of the nature, types, and criteria of values and of value judgments, especially in ethics. Now, I love to use the word axiological because it makes me sound smarter than I actually am. But there's another few phrases which describe this argument. One of them is the moral argument for God, or maybe the objective moral argument, but I'm going with the axiological argument today. Now, a good understanding of this argument can also help you answer any moral question about God, but we'll get to that towards the end. So, in order for us to figure out whether this is a good argument, we must examine whether the premises are true. So, number one, every law has a lawgiver. Now, sometime last year, in about September, my brother and I, we were in Singapore for a wee bit of a holiday with our father. And his name's Jono. We were walking around Singapore, exploring the Marina Bay Gardens, I think. And my brother whipped out some gum and chucked it in his mouth. Now, I remember hearing something about how gum's actually not too popular in Singapore. And by not being popular, I mean it's actually illegal. So I Googled it, and it turns out it is illegal to chew gum in Singapore. It's also illegal to bring gum into Singapore. Now, I just realized that I'm going to be putting this on the internet as a podcast, so I'm kind of knocking on my brother here, but hopefully no one finds out. Anyways, he was chewing gum in Singapore. Now, before he got caught for being both a gum smuggler, because he brought it into the country, and a gum chewer, and I got busted for being an accomplice to the crime, he quickly chucked it all in the bin, and the evidence was erased until his brother made a podcast talking about this whole thing. Anyways, now, this law of not being able to chew gum hasn't been around forever. We looked it up, and this law was actually introduced in 1992, and what a fantastic idea. I'm all for that in New Zealand. Now, we would have been silly to assume that this was some universal law that existed since the beginning of time. Gun laws don't just come out of nowhere. You know, there had to have been a lawmaker of this law. And you see, every type of law has an origin, whether that be the American Constitution in 1787 or the New Zealand Highway Code first introduced in 1936. Every law in our governments had an origin. They must have come from somewhere. Now, this is basic cause and effect. We see the effect, which are the laws, and logically there must have been a cause, or the lawgiver. So that's the first premise. Every law has a lawgiver. Number two, the universe has an objective moral law. You might say, but Nick, what about the laws of physics, such as the laws of thermodynamics, or the laws of gravity, or the laws of reflection? You know, I was looking around and saw some memes of people who had searched up when was gravity invented, and the answer is that comes up in Google is actually the date where Isaac Newton discovered gravity. But that's the key there. Isaac Newton didn't invent gravity. People weren't floating before he made that discovery. The key is that he made a discovery. He just discovered what gravity was. It was always there. The law of gravity had always existed, but Isaac Newton was someone to, I guess, put it into thought or describe the law. Or perhaps, you know, Johannes Kepler, did he invent planetary motion? Well, of course not. He merely just discovered the laws of planetary motion. These laws are different because unlike something like a constitutional or a road law, they weren't invented by humans. Instead, these laws were discovered. Now, does this mean that there was no maker of these laws? Could the laws of physics have come from absolutely nothing? Well, of course not, but rather we understand that there was a lawmaker outside the universe that made the laws of physics. Now we're getting into a kind of different argument for God, so we won't go down that track today. But the point is, these laws are not invented by humans. There's another unique property about these laws. Let's say, for instance, that I decided I didn't quite like gravity. Personally, I found it quite bigoted and I wanted to cancel gravity. Perhaps I organized protests against gravity. Would that mean if I jumped off a cliff, I'd start floating instead? Well, of course not, right? It doesn't matter what I think about this law, the law still exists. In fact, much more likely, even though I disagreed with it, you'd probably still find me living in a way which my actions showed that deep down I still believed in gravity. In other words, I wouldn't be jumping off rooftops and cliffs. That's because this law of gravity is objectively true. What do I mean by that? Well, there's two types of truths, objective truth and subjective truth. And to put it simply, objective truth is something which is true depending on the object of the statement or what the statement is about, and subjective truth is something which is true depending on the subject of the statement or who is making the statement. Now, let me give you an example of each and see if you can tell the difference. Number one, I believe that running to the movie soundtrack of Man of Steel is the best way to give you extra motivation. And number two, the movie soundtrack of Man of Steel was composed by Hans Zimmer. Now, which of these statements was objective and which one was subjective? Well, the first one was subjective, right? That was my own personal opinion. I believe that running to the movie soundtrack of Man of Steel is the best way to give you extra motivation. Maybe you disagree with me. Who am I to say that you're wrong? You're right in your mind and I'm right in my mind. But the second statement, the movie soundtrack of Man of Steel was composed by Hans Zimmer. If you disagreed on this one, you would be objectively wrong. Doesn't matter what you think about this. It doesn't change reality. Hans Zimmer was the one who composed that soundtrack. In fact, Stanford University define truth as this. This is called the correspondence theory of truth. What we believe or say is true if it corresponds to the way things actually are, or to the facts. If I pointed out to you that I owned a $30 million golden private jet, you'd wonder how on earth I'm making that much money running a podcast. But you'd also probably not believe me, because it doesn't correspond with reality. If you search my garage and my backyard, you'd wouldn't be finding a $30 million private jet. The point here is that something is only true if it corresponds to the way things actually are. Now, another statement I could make is that men have a great sense of direction. Now, yes, this is a subjective statement, but Ben Shapiro, he has a famous saying, and it goes like this: facts don't care about your feelings. And I was reminded of this not long ago. My friend Cam and I, we were driving down from a tramp up north, and we were dropping our friend Mason off at his home in a place called Lincoln. And it was a really rainy and misty day, and so we couldn't see the hill where I live. And I asked Cam, do you think if you were blindfolded and put just in a random spot out here in the country, you'd just better find your way home? You just have this kind of sense of where your home was. And he said, yeah, I probably would. And I said, yeah, I probably would as well. And we were talking about how great our sense of direction is. Anyway, sure enough, we start heading back towards what we thought were the hills because of our great sense of direction. And we crossed the road called Ellesmere Road. And then 5 minutes later, we crossed another road called Ellesmere Road. And what had happened is somehow we had done a full 180 and we were coming back to our friend's house in Lincoln. We didn't really have a great sense of direction. We were humbled by this experience. You see, what I did was I took a look at Google Maps, and Google Maps showed me that I was in fact going the wrong way. The objective standard of Google Maps showed me that I was wrong. My feelings were incorrect. It is objectively true that my house exists. What was it? North, south, never eat soggy wheat books. East of Lincoln. Southeast of Lincoln. You can tell I don't really have a great sense of direction from this. Anyway, the objective standard here showed me that I was wrong. Doesn't matter if I felt like I was going the right way. Objectively speaking, I wasn't. Now, we know that objective truth exists. The law of gravity is objectively true, whether I feel good about it or not. North, south, east, and west still exist. And even if I feel like I'm going west while I'm going east, I'm wrong. So is there an objective moral law of the universe, one that exists outside of our own personal preferences and opinions? If there is one, there must have been an objective moral lawmaker, the same one who made the laws of physics, God. Either there is an objective moral law, or there is no objective moral law. There can't be three options here, there are only two. Now I want you to think about an apple for a second. How do you know that an apple is rotten? If you see a really rotten apple, how do you know that it's rotten? Maybe it's all brown and soft and squishy. Maybe it's got worms crawling through it. But if you'd never seen an apple before, you wouldn't really be able to tell, right? The reason you know that an apple is rotten is because you know what a good apple looks like. You know what a ripe apple looks like. And in the same way, in order to know what evil is, we must first know what is good. We can all identify evil, so we must know naturally what is good. There must be a standard that is built into us in order to identify what is wrong. And unlike the law of gravity, the moral law may not be able to be proven by simply dropping an object and watching it fall. But the moral law, I believe, can be proven by observing our reactions to evil. You know, when we hear of school shootings and consider the events of the Holocaust or that S21 prison, when we hear of any suffering, or when we hear people chew with their mouths open while they're having dinner, we know that things aren't the way that they are supposed to be. The reason we know this is because our conscience convicts us of this. The law is written on our hearts, so we know basic right and wrong. We know that the world is supposed to be a certain way, yet we clearly see that it is not that way. And for many people, their biggest obstacle to God is the problem of evil. But the very existence of evil actually shows us that there must be a God. C.S. Lewis put it this way: my argument against God was that the universe seemed so cruel and unjust. But how had I got this idea of just and unjust? A man does not call a line crooked unless he has some idea of a straight line. What was I comparing this universe with when I called it unjust? You see, he came to the realization that there is an objective moral standard in this world, and that led him to God. The founding fathers of America believed this. They said, we hold these truths to be self-evident. that all men are created equal and they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, every one of us at some time in our life, we've probably said something like, that's not fair or that's wrong. We said these things because of our conscience. Every statement like that which is made is meaningless unless we are appealing to a standard outside of our own opinion. You know, even some atheists who deny the existence of God will acknowledge an objective moral standard. There's an atheistic philosopher by the name of Michael Ruse, and he says, "The man who says it is morally acceptable to rape little children is just as mistaken as the man who says 2 plus 2 is 5. He's appealing to that's an objective standard, maths, right? 2 plus 2 is not 5. Doesn't matter how you feel about it. There's another atheist philosopher by the name of Louise Anthony, and she says, "It's more certain that torturing babies for fun is wrong than atheism is true." However, there are some atheists who, in order to actually be consistent with their worldview, don't believe this. And this is what Richard Dawkins says in his book, River Out of Eden, A Darwinian View of Life. "In a universe of electrons and selfish genes, blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt. Other people are going to get lucky. And you won't find any rhyme or reason in it, nor any justice. The universe that we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is, at the bottom, no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but pitiless indifference." That sums up the atheistic response to evil and suffering. However, I doubt we would see Richard Dawkins truly living like this. I'm sure if he witnessed a violent act of terrorism in his neighborhood, he wouldn't just go, man, some people are going to get hurt. That's unlucky. Or if he saw a young child being abducted right in front of him, he wouldn't go, that's unlucky, and continue on with his day unbothered. Just like the person who denied the existence of gravity probably wouldn't be jumping off roofs, Richard Dawkins, I don't think, would live consistently with this. His conscience wouldn't let him. You know, he even produced a documentary called The Root of All Evil and went on to explain that it was religion. But he literally has said in his book that there is no evil. So how can there be a root of evil if there is no evil? It's contradictory. In Eastern religions like Hinduism, there's a concept that there's this thing called Brahman and Atman, and if you put them together, you get Batman. Another foundational belief is that the material world is an illusion. This is called Maya. And since morality is part of the material world, it's actually an illusion, and there is no right and wrong, good and evil. Yet, I'd wager as well that Hindus will still act in a way in which they respond to good and evil. They can't escape their God-given conscience. I think we can all agree that there is an objective standard of morality, but where does it come from? This is the question. It can either come from God, or it can't come from anywhere else. Some people will argue, in fact, this is the argument, the people who believe in objective morality but don't accredit it to God. They say maybe society determines morality. You know, maybe if we all agree on certain things, therefore that will make it right. What about Nazi society? Was the Holocaust okay then because that society thought so? Or if the majority of people in the world thought that slavery was a good thing, would that then make it objectively right? If the majority determined morality, then would Martin Luther King Jr. be considered wrong for going against the majority in his time? Would Sophie Scholl be considered evil for standing up against the majority in Nazi Germany? Of course not. This way of looking at morality does not work. It cannot be objective if it changes depending on how many people agree. C.S. Lewis, in his book Mere Christianity, put it this way. Think of a country where people were admired for running away in battle, or where a man felt proud of double-crossing all the people who had been kindest to him. You might as well try to imagine a country where 2 and 2 made 5. Although different societies have different laws when it comes to chewing gum, we all agree on basic right and wrong. Another supposed theory as to where our objective morality can come from is that evolution has formed our sense of morality. Perhaps we have this inbuilt sense because it helps us survive. Evolution says it's survival of the fittest, and survival is the highest source of good. But why? Why is survival good? According to who? You? That's your opinion. What if the flourishing of my species meant the destruction of another? Well, what if me surviving meant that someone else was not surviving as well? If stealing from my neighbor meant that I would survive better, would that make it okay? Or if rape increased the survival of the human species, would that then make it okay? Survival is not the standard of morality. Or what if I was to say that I have evolved to a different moral viewpoint? Who's to say that I'm wrong? What if we have all just evolved different moral compasses? I mean, it was tyrants like Hitler who believed in making the master race and was influenced by Darwinian thinking, or the survival of the fittest thinking, which led him to get rid of what he considered were all the weakest in society. Again, according to Dawkins, in a universe of electrons and selfish genes, how can there exist this immaterial thing called morality? Another question, why are humans the only ones that set up court systems? If we've supposedly all evolved from the same first life, why don't we see monkeys and elephants setting up court systems and prisons? Do they have the sense of justice that we do? Do they have this sense of objective morality that we do? I don't think so. Morality can only come from God, an outside source. Now you may be thinking, well, Nick, if we've got a conscience which tells us right from wrong, then why do people with these consciences sometimes think that certain evils are good? Why does the Islamic jihadist think that what he's doing is good? Why does the serial killer perhaps think that what he's doing is good? Now, the conscience does not mean that every single moral issue has a clear, obvious answer. What it does mean is that there is a basic right and wrong instilled into us that we can't escape. However, this conscience can be dulled. Think of it this way. Have you ever smacked your thumb with a hammer as you've been trying to put in a nail? You miss the nail and you smack your thumb. I've done that before, and it's extremely painful. You may have done it before as well. Now, if you've done it once, you notice how painful it was. If you did it twice in a row, it was probably even more painful. But eventually, let's suppose that you kept just whacking your thumb over and over and over again with the hammer. What would happen? Eventually, you'd actually lose feeling in your thumb. The nerves would be so destroyed by the continuous smacking from the hammer that you wouldn't be able to feel anything at all. And I think the same is true of our conscience. By repeatedly committing evil, by sinning, your conscience will be dulled. And the Bible actually talks about this. In 1 Timothy chapter 4, verse 1 to 2, it says, Now the Spirit expressly says that in latter times some will depart from the faith, giving heed to deceiving spirits and doctrines of demons, speaking lies in hypocrisy, having their own conscience seared with a hot iron. This is why people with consciences sometimes still think evil is good. I think we can confidently say that the objective moral law does exist, and it can only come from God. Now, I mentioned early on this episode that if we understand this argument, we can help answer every moral question about God. What do I mean by this? Well, let's suppose that someone said, why does God allow so much suffering? Why did God kill so many people in the Bible? Why would a good God send people to hell? Well, we can back up and say, well, what do you mean by suffering? What do you mean by evil? Is it bad what God did? What is bad? Why would a good God send people to hell? What do you mean by good? These concepts of good and evil and bad and suffering, they can only have meaning if there is an objective standard to compare them to. And this objective standard can only exist if God exists. So maybe you have a moral problem with God. Maybe you don't agree with him on something. But by what standard are you going to be making a moral judgment against him? Your standard or his? But how can we use his standard against him if he is the very source of good? Now, the axiological argument only takes us so far. How do we know what God is true? Is it the God of Christianity? who sets this moral standard, or the God of Judaism, or the God of Islam. I mean, they all fit into this category of being a objective moral lawgiver. So how do we know which one is true? And the other question is, how are we going to escape the judgment by this moral standard? We've all broken this moral standard. The Bible says, for all have sinned and fallen short of God's standard. If we've done this, then God, if he is a good God, is probably going to bring justice to the situations. We'll be punished for what we've done. This leaves us aching, longing for someone to save us. And that's where Jesus comes in. That's where the resurrection comes in. And I've got a whole podcast episode on that. I can't remember the number, but it's called Are the Gospels Historically Reliable? We look into the evidence of the resurrection to see if this does truly make sense. You know, there's hundreds of fantastic resources on the moral argument. If this is your first time ever hearing this argument, I encourage you, delve into it deeply. There are many people much brighter and wiser than me who have spoken much clearer on this issue as well, and I highly encourage you guys to look into that. But for now, that's the end of this episode. Thank you everybody for listening. Thank you for all the support throughout last year and already this year. Again, if you have any questions, feel free to reach out on social media, on the Garrison Pod, or on my email, thegarrisonpod@gmail.com, and I would love to hear those questions. If you're in Christchurch, my hometown, and you want to come and have a discussion with me or debate me or anything like that, I would love to welcome you onto the podcast as well. I truly just want to have good conversations where we hear each other's point of views more clearly. But for now, thank you everybody for listening. We'll see you on the next episode of The Garrison.